Good morning. This week, there are two events on the Jewish calendar, one that we hope to do and one that we hope not to do. This week is Parshas Pinchas, and we would love to be able to lane together. And I know all over the country, we're in different places as far as that's concerned. Some of us are able to come to shul, and some of us aren't able to come to shul. Some of us are able to partake in Kriyas HaTorah, and some of us aren't. But that's certainly something that we want to do. We all want to be together to lane Parshas Pinchas this week. The other item that's on the calendar is this Thursday is Shavasar B'Tammuz, is slated to be a fast day, and that we'd rather not do. We'd rather not fast, but we'd also rather not have the environment, have the atmosphere of Shavasar B'Tammuz. We'd rather things turn around before then. We'd rather that we have a geula and that Shavasar B'Tammuz be celebrated as a holiday. And we hope there's still some time yet, there's still a few days. Maybe we won't have to observe the 17th of Tammuz as a fast day. And it's possible that these two events, Parshas Pinchas and Shavasar B'Tammuz, in the beginning of the 3 weeks, are related. And that's an observation that you find in a number of the Sifrei HaChassidus, that it traditionally works out this way, that Parshas Pinchas happens to take place together with the beginning of the 3 weeks. And it's been suggested that perhaps there is a symbolism there. Perhaps there is a message, and it's an optimistic message, that included among the many themes in Parshas Pinchas is we read about the Moadim, we read about the festivals, and it's a reminder that Shavasar B'Tammuz also, we hope, will soon be a festival. We hope that it will be celebrated as a holiday. We hope that Tisha B'Av will be celebrated as a holiday, and we look forward to a future where that's going to happen. And therefore, to read the Parshas HaMoadim, to read about the Yomim Tovim at this time, helps to remind us that that's what's going on, and that's a future we have to aspire to and we have to work towards. It's interesting that in these various forum, there are different perspectives, different visions as to how exactly it's going to work out. The idea that Shavasar B'Tammuz should be a holiday and that Tisha B'Av should be a holiday in some of the Svarim suggests that the pattern will be that you'll have Shavasar B'Tammuz will be the first day Yontif and Tisha B'Av will be the last day Yontif, and the 3 weeks will all be Chol HaMoed. And others far, and they have it as the reverse, that Shavasar B'Tammuz will be the first day Yontif, and everything in between that and the next Tisha B'Av will be Chol HaMoed, and Tisha B'Av will be the last day Yontif. Of course, then it'll still come out that the 3 weeks will be the least happy days of the year, but we'll happily trade for such a shift in atmosphere. So that's the suggestion that some of the Sfarim have, that we read about the Moadim in Parshas Minchas to remind us that that's the future to which we look forward. But perhaps there's actually even a better remez, there's a better allusion in the psukim to that idea earlier, right in the very beginning of the parasha, because the parasha tells us that Pinchas receives a promise that Kadosh Baruch Hu says about Pinchas, Hineni nosei lo es brisi shalom, that I will give him my covenant of peace, of shalom. And that, the Gemara tells us, that's the secret. The Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah and Daf Yud Ches, which raises the question about this future when we're going to celebrate these days as Yom Tovim. It's a pasuk in Zechariah. The pasuk tells us that all of these fast days, the four fast days that now are observed in commemoration of the Churban, they will be Lebeis Yehuda, L'Sosan, L'Simcha. They will be celebrated as joyous events. So the Gemara says, fantastic. So when's that going to happen? And the answer the Gemara gives is Bizman Shiye Shalom. That at a time when there is Shalom, that is when they will flip in their nature and they will be celebrated as happy days. So the pasuk telling us that Pinchas is promised the covenant of Shalom, so perhaps that's an even stronger reference to the idea that we look forward to a time of Shalom, and that's a time when these days will be inverted, will be switched around, and they'll be celebrated as happy days. Of course, the question is, what exactly do we mean by Shalom? And if you look at the commentaries, the Ritva and others over there in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, so you'll find there's a machlokes rishonim as to what exactly is necessary to define this circumstances as shalom? Does it refer to autonomy? Does it refer to the Beis HaMikdash? It seems like it refers to something eschatological. It refers to something associated with the Mashiach, something that we haven't yet reached. It's perhaps ironic or appropriate, depending on how you look at it, that we can't even agree on the definition of what shalom means, what exactly it is, the shalom that we're looking for in order to have the shalom that will restore our joy. But one way or another, we're told that when we reach this state of shalom, so that's when we can celebrate these days as Yomim Tovim. And the question of how exactly to relate to the concept of shalom, which is itself a machlokes, is also a question how to relate to this pasuk, where we're told about Pinchas's promise of shalom. There, the pasuk has the word shalom in an unusual fashion, as the Gemara emphasizes the vav in shalom is split, is broken, and that's telling us something as well. And that also is a major machlokes, what exactly it means. The Gemara tells us that it's broken or small or split or something along those lines. And there are a number of different opinions among the Rishonim and among the Achronim, Rabbi Akiva Eiger and others, as to how exactly the Vav is supposed to look in the Sefer Torah. It makes a big difference because it has to be correct in order for the Sefer Torah to be acceptable. So here also we have so many different opinions. What does the word shalom look like? What is the concept shalom look like that we aspire to? We have to first figure out how to relate to the word and to the concept of shalom, but one way or another, that's what we're aiming for in order to be able to celebrate this week, in order to be able to celebrate this month, in order to be able to look to a different kind of future. And perhaps we could spend a few minutes considering the rest of that pasuk, the pasuk in Zechariah, which tells us that we ultimately will be celebrating. The pasuk concludes, V'ha'emes v'ha'shalom ehavu, and truth and peace are beloved. And that is an important concept in halacha as well. How exactly do we relate to a conflict, to a clash between truth and peace? And here we find a fascinating concept that we know on the one hand that we're told to be resolutely honest, midvar sheker tirchak, the Torah tells us in Parshas Mishpatim. And we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's seal is emes, that God's seal is truth. And yet, at the same time, the Gemara also tells us in Maseches Yevamos that there are times when we're ready to compromise on truth, that if there is a threat to shalom, if there is a need to move around the facts, perhaps, in order to keep the peace, in order to maintain the peace, or to advance the peace. So the Gemara tells us an opinion. Over there in Yevamos, there are a number of opinions, but the first opinion is mutter lishanos bedvar hashalom, that it is permissible, I won't say right now, to lie. To lishanos means to change things a little bit, to change the facts in order to maintain the peace. And the Gemara understands this from a story in Chumash and Parshas Vayechi, without going into the details now in the interest of time. But the Gemara understands that there is a heter, there is a license to be less than absolutely factually honest in order to maintain the peace. So that's the first opinion in the Gemara, and that's itself very striking, the idea that even though we're so committed to honesty, it's the seal of God, it's what we're all about, yet nonetheless, if there's a threat to shalom, so then shalom is still going to be our priority. But that's only the first opinion in the Gemara, that it's mutter lishanos. The Gemara has a second opinion that disagrees and says it's not mutter lishanos. It's not permissible to change the truth for the sake of peace. Rather, mitzvah lishanos bifnei hashalom. It's an obligation. You have to change the truth if that's what's necessary in order to uphold the peace. One shouldn't get the impression that it's only something that's permissible, that it's only something that's allowed. It's a chiyuv, it's a mitzvah. And that the Gemara has a proof for, also a proof from Sefer Shmuel. We can see from a certain directive that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave that this isn't only an option, but this is a mitzvah. If peace is threatened, so then we're going to have to change the peace, we have to change the truth in order to bring about or in order to maintain peace. And then the Gemara has actually a third opinion, a third statement. It says the Gemara, even further than the first two, not only is it permissible, not only is it an obligation, but even HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself does this. And this is a more well-known reference, the reference in Parshas Vayera, where we find that when Sarah overhears that she's going to have a baby at her advanced age, she expresses surprise and she says, I can't believe it, my husband is so old. How is it likely that I'm going to have a child at this age? And the next pasuk, right after that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates this to Avraham Avinu, and it comes out a little differently. It doesn't have the same emphasis that Sarah had that Avram was old. It sounds like she's saying, yeah, it's unlikely old, somebody's old. It sounds like she's talking about her being old. And the Gemara tells us that this is an example of even a Kadosh Baruch Hu being ready to change the truth in order to maintain the peace. So how exactly does that happen? If we are so committed to truth, if it is so vital to our identity and to our ability to emulate God, who seals truth, so how does it happen that truth is going to step aside, is going to make room for shalom? So here, the discussion that we find in the Sifrei HaAchronim, there are two basic approaches. And one is to look to this pasuk in Zechariah, the same pasuk that promises us this joyous future at this time of year. So the pasuk ends, as we said, with this phrase, Va'emes v'hashalom ehavu, that truth and peace are beloved. So how could we read the message there? It sounds like it's telling us that there are two pillars that we stand by, that there are two goals, there are two values that we look to when we live our life. On the one hand, we want to be people of truth. And on the other hand, we want to be people of peace. And ideally, we will live lives that do honor to both values. But what happens if there's a conflict? What if you can't have both at the same time? What if you're going to have to choose? What if they're clashing with each other? So then it sounds like it's a reasonable decision to go either way. It sounds like it's fair to say, I am going to sacrifice truth to whatever extent necessary and show honor to peace. It's an equivalent value. Or it's also reasonable, it's also understandable to go the other way and to say that I'm going to focus on truth as the ultimate value, and I'm not going to focus as much on shalom. So if we read this pasuk to tell us that there are these two equivalent values and they can't both be accommodated, there's a clash. If I'm going to tell the truth, it's going to compromise peace. And if I'm going to focus on peace, I'm going to have to compromise truth. If something's going to have to give, if the two values are equal, so then it makes sense that I have to choose one. And perhaps that's what the Talmud is telling us, mutter lishanos, that it is permissible to lie for the sake of peace, or permissible to change the truth for the sake of peace. But there's another perspective as well, and especially if we look to the second opinion in the Talmud, that it's not only permissible, but it's a mitzvah. It's not something we have the right to choose, but we have an obligation, we have a clear path to choose peace over truth. So then we could say that, yes, it's still a values clash, but maybe it's not 50-50. Maybe peace is clearly the victor and it's going to take the path no matter what. That's going to be what's going to direct us despite the clash. Or maybe we could say it's not even a clash. Maybe it's not even a conflict. And it goes to the question of how exactly do we define the prohibition of midvar sheker tirchak? That here we understand that the Torah prohibits us from lying. And clearly we know honesty is the best policy. That's no question. And it's the seal of God. So we have to understand as a prohibition, midvar sheker tirchak, how exactly do we relate to that? How exactly do we understand that as an isser? And here you find a number of opinions, and it comes to the fact that there's an unusual language here. That if the Torah wants to prohibit something, so there are all kinds of words. There are four words, to be precise, the Talmud says. There are four different words the Torah uses for a language of prohibition. Why is it that when it comes to sheker, the Torah says tirchak? Why doesn't it say don't, hishomer, pen, lav, al? These are the words the Torah uses for a prohibition. What's with tirchak? Why does it say stay away? And there are some who understand that this is an extreme iser, that this isn't a normal prohibition, but this is a prohibition of greater intensity. That's the language of the Sefer HaChinuch, where it says that the Torah uses this kind of wording because meirov tiuvo. It's so disgusting, it's so objectionable to say something false, so the Torah goes to an extreme and tells us, don't even come close. And there are others who understand it perhaps in the other end of the spectrum and saying that it's not an absolute prohibition. And when there is an absolute no, an absolute ban, so then the Torah says don't. But here the Torah says, Tirchak says avoid. It's telling us that it's not something that's absolute, and perhaps there are exceptions. And there is a discussion in the Rishonim and later as to what exactly is the scope of Midvar Sheker Tirchak as an Isser. And there's a little bit of a parallel perhaps in terms of secular law. So if I were to say something not true right now, if I were to say that the sky is green, so then it's not true, but it's not a crime. You don't go to jail for saying something that's not true. When would you go to jail? When is it a crime to say something that's false? So theoretically, if one commits perjury, if one lies in a formal courtroom setting or something like that, or if one causes somebody a loss through his lying, so we call fraud. If I deceive somebody and they lose money, they lose something else, so then that's a crime. So both of those are possibilities within halacha as well. So for example, the Gemara in the middle of Masechta Shavuos has a number of drashos on Midvar Sheker Tirchak and what exactly is included in that prohibition. And there, it's mostly within a courtroom setting. It's mostly within a formal environment that we find the prohibition being applied. So that is one possibility, that maybe the Isser as an actual prohibition is specifically when it is a formal setting such as a Besdin, such as a courtroom, but not necessarily with the same weight in a more informal context. And the idea that fraud or something of that kind is the Isser is a view that you find in the Sefer Yireim. The Sefer Yireim, one of the great Rishonim, understood that Sheker is an Avera bin Adam l'Chavero, that it is an Avera on an interpersonal level, and it's based on the fact that you harm someone by deceiving them. But perhaps if you're not causing any harm, if you're not causing any negative impact, so maybe it's not technically included in the prohibition of Midvar Sheker Tirchak. Now, that's not to say, God forbid, that we're casual about honesty. Even if it's not technically under the prohibition, it doesn't mean that it's something we take lightly. We still say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's seal is truth. We still say that we believe resolutely in the value of honesty. But as a prohibition that's going to compete with the mandate of Shalom, which is its own crucial mitzvah, and we read a few weeks ago Parshas Korach, where we find a prohibition of machlokes, and we find the opposite of that in the behavior of Moshe of seeking peace, and we're told that we have to emulate that. There is an absolute mitzvah of Shalom. So perhaps when there is a conflict, it isn't really much of a fight. It isn't really much of a conflict, and Shalom is the clear victor. So this gives us two perspectives, how to relate to this idea that we can be Mishane b'fnei HaShalom, that we can change the truth for the sake of peace. We find two ways to look at that. Is it because there's a clash between these two values? Emes v'shalom are both so beloved to us, as the Pasuk tells us, and therefore if we can't accommodate both, we're going to have to choose one or the other? Or is it perhaps because the prohibition of Sheker doesn't really apply in this case? Shalom is a whole different world. And while, yes, we're committed to being as honest as possible, the mandate of Shalom is going to be the clear priority, and it isn't really much of a clash. So this question manifests itself in halacha in a number of ways. And just to quickly mention a few. So first of all, the question of the two opinions in the Talmud, is it mutter or is it a mitzvah? Is it something that's an option or is it something that's an obligation? Also seems to be a debate later, seems to be a debate in the Rishonim as well. The Gemara Maseches Bav Metzia, in the second parak, the Gemara has a discussion about the obligation of Hashavas Aveda, that we have to return lost items, we have to give back property that was lost. But the Gemara tells us that we have to be careful. We have to make sure that the one who's coming to claim the item is actually the one who lost it, is actually the owner. So the Torah tells us, as the Gemara interprets, that we have to darshehu, we have to ask him for some proof. We have to ask him for simanim, for some indications that indeed he's the one who owns this item. But the Gemara says that if the individual is a Talmud Chacham, so then you're not going to have to push for proof. What do we mean by a Talmud Chacham here? So here we mean, as the Talmud tells us, it's somebody who's Eino Mishane B'diburo, somebody who is resolutely honest. He's not going to say anything that's false. So if somebody is known to have integrity, of this level, so then they're not obligated to approve the point. And if they look at the item and they say, yeah, that's mine, that's what I lost, so then we're allowed to trust them and we're allowed to return it to them. And in that context, the Gemara says there are a few cases where if somebody says something that's not totally true, if somebody says something it's not 100% correct, it's legitimate, it's okay, and that doesn't hurt their reputation. They'll still be considered an honest person and will still accept what they claim as true. And the Gemara gives us three cases. So on the one hand, if a person wants to not be 100% accurate about who gave them a great meal, if they had a wonderful repast at someone's house, and everyone's wondering, wow, where did you have that great suda? And you don't want to tell them because you're afraid that everyone's going to descend on this person and asking for hospitality, and you want to protect them. So Talmud says, okay, that's an example. That's where you don't have to be totally honest. You don't have to tell the truth so that you can protect your host from being overwhelmed by requests for dinner. And the Gemara also says, Masechta, that if somebody asks you, did you learn this Masechta? So then you don't have to tell them that you did. If you want to play it down, presumably for the sake of modesty, because you don't want to show off, so that apparently that's also legitimate. To go in the other direction, that's a problem. The Yerushalmi and Makkos tells us to overplay how much you've learned and to get more respect than you deserve, that's a problem. But if you want to go in the other direction, you want to play it down, you want to say that you know less, so then the Talmud says that's also acceptable. It doesn't hurt your reputation. And the third is a puraya, which literally translates as bed. It sounds like it's a reference to the relationship between a husband and wife. If somebody asks questions that are none of their business, so then there's no obligation to be 100% accurate and forthright in answering them. So the Talmud says, here are three cases where you could say something that's not totally true, and it's not going to hurt your reputation. You'll still be entitled to get your property back just based on your identification. So the Rishonim ask, isn't something missing from the list? What about Shalom? What if somebody deviates from the truth for the sake of peace? Shouldn't that also be on the list? Why does the Gemara leave that out of this list of three items? So some of the Rishonim, Tosfos over there, writes, it's not left off the list, it is the list. That all of these examples are cases where you're trying to avoid a fight, you're trying to prevent machlokas, so therefore you're going to try to say something that is going to be more harmonious, even if it's not 100% accurate. So the Gemara is not leaving out Shalom, it's just giving different examples. So what about Masechta? We said that Masechta was a situation where somebody's trying to be more humble, is trying to be more modest, and plays down how much they learn. So I heard once from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Tzadik Levracha, was talking about how his grandfather, Reb Chaim, had a practice that if he didn't want to get into a fight with someone, he didn't want to argue, he would say, I didn't learn that Masechta. I can't fight with you about it. I can't argue. I didn't learn that. So that was his way of saying, I'm going to stay out of the fight. So sometimes that's also part of the intent of maybe playing down how much learning you have. So that's how some of the Rishonim understand that all of these are examples of Shalom. It's not leaving it out of the list. It is the list. But other Rishonim, the Rush, and the Rif, and others have a different approach here. And they say the reason that Shalom is not on the list is because this list is discretionary. This list are areas where you are able to say something not 100% true, and it's not going to hurt your reputation. But Shalom, the Rishonim say, that's a mitzvah, that's an obligation. So I don't need the Talmud to tell me that if I do what I have to do, it's not going to hurt my reputation. If I do what I'm obligated to do, I'm not going to be thought less of. Clearly, if that's the case, that I'm obligated to do it, so that's what I have to do. That's not going to hurt my reputation. The Talmud here was just saying that these are situations where one could choose and one could go a little bit further, and still they're going to be considered to be honest people. But if it's Shalom, so that's a mitzvah, and of course that's the case. So when you find that position in the Rishonim, it's interesting to note that the Rambam has it differently, and the Rambam has the language where it sounds like it's more of a choice, it's more of an option. And perhaps this reflects two different perspectives, that maybe the Rishonim who say it's a clear mitzvah, they understand that sheker is not really an issue here. It's not really a prohibition. There's a mandate of Shalom, and that's what we're focused on, and that's got to be the priority. While the Rambam perhaps is understanding that really there is a clash, there is an isser of sheker at the same time as there is a mitzvah of Shalom, and we have to try to figure out what we're going to prioritize, and every situation is going going to require our careful attention, and we will choose whatever is going to seem more indicated in the moment. And that may also affect the question of whether one can overtly say something false, say something that's completely not true, or maybe the Talmud is being precise in its language, and we've always been hesitant so far to translate it as lying. The language of the Gemara of Mutter Lishanos is different perhaps than Mutter Lishaker, which would sound more clearly like it's talking about an actual falsehood. Maybe Lishanos means that we can say something that's not 100% factual. It would not be acceptable, for example, in the business world where we need 100% accuracy and integrity. Here we're saying it doesn't have to rise to that standard, but to say something that's really false, to say something that's really sheker, so perhaps that we wouldn't allow. And here the Rambam also seems to have this language. The Rambam's language is that it's mutter, not l'shaker, not even l'shanos. The way the Rambam has it, l'hosif u'ligroa, to add a little bit, to take away a little bit, change things a tiny bit, to say something it's not 100%. Sounds like the Rambam, again, is struggling with this tension, not to say that it's completely mutter, there's no concern of sheker at all. There is very much a concern of sheker. But at the same time, it's something that we can balance together with Shalom and figure out how to address. And this is something that we find in many other places as well, coming up as a tension. For example, if anyone's ever been to a Jewish wedding, so they know the question that's asked, Ketzad Miraktim Lifnei HaKala, how does one dance in front of a Kala? And we know the answer. The answer is Kala Nava Chasuda. We say she's a beautiful bride. And what they don't tell you at the wedding, what the band doesn't convey to you, that actually it's a machlokis in the Gemara, that we follow that opinion, that we say Kala Nava Chasuda. That's the view of Beis Hillel. But there was another opinion, the opinion of Beis Shammai, that Beis Shammai maintained that can't necessarily say Kala Nova Chasuda. Beis Shammai asked, what if you're not so impressed? So doesn't the Torah tell us you have to be honest, Mivar Shekir Tirchak? So rather say something that you can get behind, say something that you can stick with, and don't say something that you don't believe, Kala Kamoshahu, say something that you are actually confident about. And here the Shulchan Aruch and the wedding bands have taken the opinion of Beis Hillel that we say Kala Nava Chasuda no matter what. But it prompts the question that this actually seems like the self-evident approach. Don't we know that we're allowed to be less than 100% factual for the sake of Shalom? So certainly you're not going to say anything else. Certainly you're not going to say the opposite. So where is Beis Shammai coming from? What's the concern? The Gemara has three opinions. It's permissible l'shanus b'fnei HaShalom. It's a mitzvah l'shanus b'fnei HaShalom. And even God does it. So where does Beis Shammai find the problem? Beis Shammai was firmer than God? There's no opinion that says that you're not allowed to be mishanah b'fnei HaShalom. So where exactly does the objection come from that you can't say Kala Nav Chasuda? So I saw once an explanation in the Sefer Kochva Yitzchak of Rav Yitzchak Sternhill, where he suggested that perhaps the machlokis is that Beis Shammai, it's not the way he put it, but just to put it in a modern context, that Beis Shammai lived a long time ago before there were video cameras at the weddings. So when Beis Shammai went to a wedding, people didn't come over to them in the middle of the meal with a video camera and say, listen, tell us, what do you think of the Kala? So then Beis Shammai for sure would say, Kala Nava Chasuda, of course. If you ask me to say something, I'll say Kala Nava Chasuda. But if no one's asking, so why should I jump in the middle of the circle and start screaming out something I don't believe in? If no one's putting me on the spot, so then I don't have to compromise my integrity at all, and I should only say something I believe in, Kala Kamoshi. So if that's the case, so then Beis Hillel, the dominant opinion that we follow, so Beis Hillel's opinion must be, by inference, that not only are you allowed to say something not 100% accurate when you're forced to, but even proactively, you can take a preemptive strike on behalf of Shalom. You can do whatever it takes in order to add extra Shalom because it's such a crucial value. And it sounds like what you have here is the same question, that do we believe that Shalom and Emes are in a clash and we reluctantly pick one over the other? Or are we saying that no, here Shalom is the clear victor and it's not even much of an issue? We don't have to worry that there is a concern of Sheker as well. And you find this in a few other places. So for example, Rav Kook in his Chidush HaManat Gemara quotes an anonymous Talmud Chacham who maintained that the heter l'shanus b'fnei hashalom is only for somebody who has his midos and balance in general. But when somebody is at an extreme, the Rambam generally advocates that we take the golden mean, that we have the middle path in all of our midos. But if we're at one extreme, we sometimes have to go to the other extreme, as the Vilna Gaon discussed, in order to self-correct. So this anonymous Chacham said that when somebody is in balance, okay, they can be mishanif nehashalom, they can change the truth for the sake of peace. But if somebody is having issues with honesty, so then they need to go to the opposite extreme of honesty in order to self-correct, and they should not be mishana, they shouldn't change the truth, even for the sake of peace. And Rav Kook disagreed. Rav Kook said, do your self-improvement program on your own time. But when you have a situation of shalom, it's not an option. It's a mitzvah lishanus b'fnei hashalom, and therefore that's your option. That's what you have to do. It's your only choice, and it's not something that you can decide, well, this isn't my avoda right now, I'm not going to do that. You have a clear mandate of shalom. And perhaps it's the same machlokas that the anonymous chacham was saying, that we have a clash here, we have a conflict, while Rav Kook was saying it's not much of a conflict. Shalom is the clear mandate, and that's where we have to go. And this is an issue that comes up in a number of other machlokasim that we could see. But in the interest of shalom, we're not going to spend too much time. But I'll just mention that there is an opinion that the Sefer Chassidim maintained, and it's quoted in the Magen Avraham and Shulchan Aruch. So it's interesting, because this opinion of the Sefer Chassidim, I don't think this reflects the normative halacha as far as we understand, but it is quoted in the Magen Avraham as a very authoritative source, so it's certainly worth our attention. And it has to do with the situation that happens to us very often. Let's say somebody comes and asks you for money, and you don't want to give this person the money for whatever reason. So the minig is to say, I don't have any money. That seems to be the accepted practice, whether or not it's 100% true. And I think we assume that it's b'nei hashalom, that the alternative to say, well, actually, I have a lot of money, I just cashed my paycheck, I'm actually quite filled with cash right now, I'm just not interested in giving any to you, that's probably not the wisest approach. And therefore, to say, I don't have any, is an acceptable path over here. But it's interesting to note that the Sefer Chassidim wasn't so sure, and the Sefer Chassidim has an idea that the notion of changing the truth for the sake of peace, that's only true about something in the past, but something going on right now or something in the future, he says, then you have to be resolutely honest and you can't change the truth at all. And it's the whole discussion whether this is accepted lahalach or not, and again, I don't think it necessarily is. I think our practice still is to say, I don't have, when we're looking to avoid conflict. But the position is interesting. What exactly does it reflect? Where does this limitation come from about things that are in the past versus things that are in the present or the future? And the commentaries struggle to define it, and some suggest that it was Chazal expressing the concern that the idea of saying you can change the truth for the sake of peace, anything could be defined as shalom if we take a broad enough perspective, and therefore the whole concept of emes would fall away, and maybe that's what the concern is. But perhaps we could also suggest that what the Sefer Chassidim is getting at is that, yes, you're allowed and you're encouraged to choose peace when there's a conflict between peace and truth and there's no choice. You have to do one or the other. You're going to have to compromise one. So then, yes, okay, you should choose peace over truth. But what if there are three options? What if you have three different ways you could go? Either you could compromise peace, or you could compromise truth, or it's possible, even if it's not so ideal otherwise, but it's possible to accommodate both. Maybe in that case, you should accommodate both at whatever cost, even if it means it's unpleasant, but it's not going to require you to sacrifice either truth or peace. So in this situation, when someone's asking you for money, really there are three choices. You could lie, you could change the truth and say, I don't have any money. You could say, I have lots of money, I'm not interested in giving it to you, and cause a fight. Or you could give him what he's asking for. It's not always the most attractive option, but it doesn't require you sacrificing either truth or peace, perhaps. And maybe that's what the Sefer Chassidim is getting at, that we have to really value both of these principles to such an extent that if it's possible in any way to accommodate both, so that's what we're going to do. And perhaps that's the message that we find within this whole discussion, and maybe that's what the pasuk is getting at, that the idea of ha'emes v'hashalom ahavu is telling us that we have to revere both peace and truth with such passion and with such commitment that we're going to do whatever it takes not to have to sacrifice one for the other, not to have to trade, not to have to say that I'll compromise one because the other is my priority, but if we can set up our lives so that we revere truth and we revere peace so much that we'll do whatever we can to make sure they're not in conflict. That's what the pasuk is really telling us to do. And it's striking to note that when we go back to the question of the pasuk in Mishpatim, Midvar Sheker Tirchok, that we should stay far away from falsehood. And we mentioned the question, why is that the language of the Torah? Why does the Torah not just say don't? Shomer, pen, lava, why does it say stay far away from falsehood? The Lutzker Rav, the Oznayim L'Torah of Zalman Sorotskin, writes that the reason the Torah uses this language of Tirchak is because we know it's not an absolute prohibition. There are times when you're going to have to compromise the truth, such as if it's for the sake of peace. Yes, there are times when Sheker is not the only concern, and Shalom, for example, will take priority. But what's the pasuk telling us? It's telling us that we should revere the truth so much that we will do whatever we can to make sure that those situations are few and far between, that we're not going to place ourselves in a context where we're likely to have to do that, but we will try to show absolute commitment to Shalom and absolute commitment to Emes at the same time. So when it happens and we're stuck, okay, yes, Shalom is a crucial priority. But if we can take care to set up our lives that it's not going to be in conflict, so then that's the highest level, and that's what the Torah is telling us. Midvar Sheker Tirchok. Try to have foresight and try to plan in advance that you're not going to likely have to compromise one or the other. And perhaps that's the message the Pasuk is telling us, that if we want these days, Pasuk in Zechariah is telling us that if we want these days, if we want Shavuos Batamas and we want Tisha B'Av to be L'Sasson L'Simcha, so what's it going to take to get us to that state of L'Sasson L'Simcha? Ha'emes v'hashalom ehavu, that if we love peace and we love truth and we love them equally and they are high on our priority list, so we'll do whatever we can to maintain the both of them and have them both coexist, so then that's the state that we need to be in order to flip things around. And it's a crucial message, and it's interesting that this same Lutzker Rav, the Oznayim L'Torah, in his commentary to this week's Parsha, to Parsha's Pinchas, so he asks, why is the Vav broken in the word Shalom? Why is it that we have this unusual letter? It's to show us that there is something that we're still sad about, that even though Pinchas brings about Shalom, but he had to do so with an act of aggression, he had to do so with an act of violence, and that's something that still makes us unhappy, that's still not the perfect world that we're looking for, so that Shalom is broken, and we're looking for a Shalom that doesn't require any type of harm to anyone, doesn't require any kind of aggression, and when we can have that, when we can have ha'emes v'hashalom ahavu, so then we can understand that that's going to be the context that's going to reverse this time of year for us. And it's striking to note that one of the things that we commemorate theoretically this Thursday on Shavuos Batamas, we have a fast day, one of the things that we commemorate is the Shviras HaLuchos, is when Moshe Rabbeinu broke the Luchos. And it's interesting to note that the Medrash tells us that the Pasuk in Kisiso says, for the second Luchos, Psal Lucha Shnei Luchos Avonim Karishonim, that Moshe is told he should make the second set of Luchos. And Chazal say over there, you should make them yourselves, Psal Lucha, you should know the cost of these Luchos that you tossed off the side of a mountain. They don't grow on trees. You should know how expensive they are. You should know what goes in to making luchos. And the Bali Musar asks, well, what's going on here? Don't we say that Moshe did the right thing? It's a luchos asher shibarta. Chazal say, asher koach shibarta. It's the right thing that you broke these luchos. So why is Moshe being criticized? And the Bali Musar explained that yes, Moshe did the right thing. It's what had to be done in that moment. But it doesn't mean that we're free of worrying or caring about the cost. That here, there was a great opportunity that had to be sacrificed. The luchos had to be destroyed. We have to remember what that cost in order to be able to get past this, in order to be able to grow from the experience. So we have to recognize what the trade-off is and to acknowledge that there is a loss here, even when that is the right decision, just as when one has to compromise truth for the sake of peace. So maybe that's the right decision. Maybe that's the call that has to be made, but we still have to feel a sense of what exactly was lost. And this idea that the Shalom is broken, that the Vav is broken, somehow in the word shalom. So we'll just end with this note. As we said before, it's a machlokas rishonim, how exactly that plays out, what exactly that looks like. According to some of the rishonim, it looks like a vav is broken into two letters, like it's two yuds. We'd read the word yashlim if you spread it around. And according to another one, it looks as if it's missing completely. So the word would be shalem. So there are different opinions as to what it looks like. According to another opinion, Rabbeinu Bachi, it looks like a very small vav. And perhaps each one of these has a Musar lesson to us. So Rabbeinu Bachi's idea of a small vav is the idea that sometimes in order to bring about shalom, we have to be able to set our ego aside. We have to be able to say that we're not so important and we can step aside for shalom. And perhaps the other two ideas also, that we have either a shalom that really reads shalem, that reads as if there's no vav there at all, represents the idea that shalom is harmony, that everything has to be together as one, that everything has to be able to be honored to its proper requirement, its proper necessity. And the idea that it breaks down into two yuds, yashlim, represents the idea that it has to be a lasting shalom. It has to be not only an expedient shalom of the moment, but something that will take us into the future in a sense of harmony. And if we're able to do that, if we're able to honor all of our values together so that nothing has to be compromised for the other, and that we are people who are of shlemus, who are complete, so then, God willing, we should soon reach the moment, hopefully very soon reach the moment, when the 17th of Tammuz and the 9th of Av are not days of crying and of fasting, but rather, as the Pasuk promises us, of Sasan and Simcha. I wish you all a glorious future and redemption in every sense of the word, and we should soon celebrate together.